Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail.
Welcome to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast. I'm Trent Kling for Layton Working Behind the Scenes. Coming up on this week's episode, we'll be joined by Rick Watson, the founder and CMO of RMW Commerce Consulting. Rick's retail accomplishments include a number of different things. We'll talk a little bit about those, but mostly we're going to talk about a few different topics. Number one, what holiday sales and specifically e-commerce holiday sales could look like, including which retailers might benefit from the current climate and which retailers may struggle. We'll also talk about decision-making and planning in a mixed economic climate. He's got some great things to say regarding the structure of organizations and how data sharing should become more prevalent in between silos at retail companies. In news, we'll discuss a new report from CBRE, and looks pretty good, at least on the retail front, and we'll look ahead to a couple of attorney generals suing a delivery company regarding worker classification. A quick reminder that you can check us out on social media at Retail Podcast on both Instagram and Twitter. Also, if you enjoy the show, please do hit that subscribe button so we can float on into your podcast subscription service. Each week, we upload a new episode. So let's get to that CBRE report. And again, CBRE, a major player in terms of all forms of real estate, but specifically for retail real estate. And these numbers in this report indicate increasing retail strength actually heading into the holiday season. So CBRE releases these quarterly retail reports. Their report just released this week from the third quarter. And this particular report indicates that at the very least, retailers are pretty bullish around brick and mortar and landlords are responding in kind, but developers might not be following that trend quite as much. So maybe the most important number here, retail availability rate, was shown to have dropped to just 5% by the end of the third quarter. This is around 100 basis points lower than what it was in 2021. And what's more, the 5% availability rate is the lowest rate since CBRE began to track this metric back in 2005. Availability rate, so this differs from vacancy rates or occupancy rates in that it measures the amount of commercial real estate, in the retail sense in this case, available to lease up versus the overall amount of retail commercial real estate that exists. So you might have vacant spaces that'll show up in vacancy rates that for one reason or another, maybe it's a settlement with the vacating business or what have you, they might be unavailable. Likewise, properties under construction that haven't yet been leased up might be included in availability rate if they're being advertised. So that's really what we're talking about. So overall, in terms of retail real estate, that means 95% of it out there in the country is unavailable at the end of the third quarter. And again, that's the lowest since CBRE started tracking that number. And I think it's important to keep some perspective here. When you think about all the experts over the last 10 years that said that the U.S. was over-retailed, that there was up to 30% more, some people said even up to 50% more retail real estate than was needed. These people would say we'd see mass vacancies. And you really have to wonder if the metrics they were working from aren't perhaps maybe the best measurables or the most complete measurables to use. And to be clear, this isn't a swing at those experts. Obviously, everyone entitled to their own opinion. But I think it's important to look at what was driving these experts to really believe this over the last 5 to 6 years. Maybe there was an underlying doubt in consumers' willingness to leave their house, especially coming out of the pandemic, or maybe an underlying doubt in consumer strength or confidence. And lately, you could see how that would be driven by low consumer sentiment levels. Maybe it was perhaps too great a focus on these big box retailers or mall retailers who have closed shop in the last decade versus a focus on some of these growing brands and niche retailers that are holding their own in A-class centers. And you look also at freestanding real estate, the likes of Dollar General, who have really expanded. And you talk about companies that are in growth mode. Maybe it's a willingness to kind of disregard those companies as major players in a retail sense. Now, getting back to availability rate, when you break it down by retail format, freestanding formats led the way in low availabilities. They were well under that 5% average. So as we talked about, the likes of Dollar General, Family Dollar, and Dollar Tree now back into growth mode, especially with those combo stores. seeing well below 5% average availability rate for freestanding stores. Power centers, their availability rate down to 5.4%. And you look at neighborhood and strip centers, those were over 9% availability in the early days of the pandemic. Availability for those properties is now just at 7.1%, which really speaks to why they've become kind of the darlings of the retail world. And a lot of the interviewees we've had on during the past year have talked about retailers wanting to seek out those neighborhood and smaller strip centers. Mall availability, meanwhile, good news for the mall sector, that continues to hover just over 6%, and that's been basically flat for the year. So you're seeing even movement in the mall space in terms of availability, which is, I think, good for most of those mall operators and shopping center operators. Other metrics in this report include average asking rent. And as a consequence of demand and some other factors, average asking rent also went up year over year to $22.55 per square foot per year. Now, this is mostly impacting retailers who are either coming to the end of their current leases or who are inking new leases. Some of the other factors to this increase would include maybe the increased gravitation of retailers towards the A-class centers, renovation of some existing lower-class centers that are out there, and new builds for expanding retailers. Now, that last factor, the new build factor, that might be the least impactful. We'll talk about why here in just a second. But it does bear mention that this increase in average asking rent, it's just 2.5% year over year. So that does lag inflation. And again, we can look to retailers who are inking these long-term leases in A-class centers. We're talking 15, 20, 25-year leases. Grocery stores and neighborhood centers also would be a great example of this as reasons why we see that restriction of rental rate growth. So again, that's great for retailers. You lock in some sense of certainty, but also a big reason why that 2.5% increase year over year in average asking rent, that's going to lag inflation. And we talked about new builds maybe being the least impactful in terms of driving up the average asking rent. Retail deliveries, or basically new retail space finished during a time span, is just 25.1 million square feet year to date in 2022. Since CBRE began tracking this, that's a record low. So you're not seeing the developers construct as many properties. This is resulting in now some demand for some of the older properties, some of the properties that might not have been sought after even 5 years ago. So you create an atmosphere where retail space has become very resistant to potential negative factors, something that we saw during the pandemic. The pandemic certainly could have cratered the retail real estate market overall. But again, you kind of wonder if those that were projecting maybe negative forecasts, who saw a pullback in occupancy rates, who said that there would be a lot of retail vacancy in the early 2020s, maybe they weren't taking into account the low levels of new builds. The level of new builds in terms of what it adds to the overall square footage of retail in the U.S. has annually been below 1% of the total supply in the last decade. So what this tells us is there's not a lot of new construction going on. There's not a lot of new properties to lease up. As a result, the existing properties are increasingly leasing more and more and more. And so while you might hear the news stories about the C-class malls or the D-class malls being emptied out, being refurbished, being torn down, the reality of it is in most of the country, in most of the United States, and for most of these shopping centers, whether they be malls or power centers or neighborhood centers, you're seeing a lot of vacancies being backfilled now because retailers and service industries want to jump into those spaces. But there's not enough new space, not enough new builds going on in suburbia. And we've talked about this in the grocery landscape, especially with the likes of Kroger and the likes of Target and the likes of Walmart curtailing some of their new construction in areas where you're really seeing that population growth in exchange for investment in e-commerce. I think you're starting to see Kroger backtrack on that strategy just a little bit and start to plan more and more new builds, especially some of these other retail grocers. You look at Publix in the Southeast, HEB recently did it in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. Some of these other regional grocers have not been shy about brick and mortar growth versus some of the national players. So that goes hand in hand with kind of what we're seeing in the retail real estate market over the last 5 years, where not a lot of new builds. So this is driving rents at least slightly up for some of these older locations. Now, despite the decrease in availability rates and all of this stuff that we talk about with occupancy being driven up in retail real estate, and you have the growth in rents, non-store retail sales, which would be e-commerce sales and other sales that are out there, the growth there outpaced in-store retail sales growth in the third quarter. Now, both categories did grow, but e-commerce seems to be cycling back to slight growth over brick and mortar after we saw what some termed e-commerce burnout kind of in 2021, the later half of 2021, and the early portion of 2022. Year over year, e-commerce sales far outpaced inflation based on CBRE's evaluation. It was up 13.8%. Meanwhile, core retail sales were up 8.2% year over year. So you could say just 8.2% compared to the 13.8%, but still looking pretty good. Based on these numbers, CBRE expects total sales for the holiday season to be up 6.9% across the board. And that's far more bullish than most forecasts that are out there. Net absorption, which is another metric that CBRE looks at in this sense, that was actually down on the retail CRE front, at least quarter versus quarter. It's still positive by 14.2 million square feet, but in terms of the growth, it was down a little bit. And that's due largely to existing high occupancy rates. You're just running out of places for retailers to go and those low levels of new development compared to 2021. But I mentioned it grew by 14.2 million more square feet. Basically, that means that 14.2 million more square feet were occupied at the end of the third quarter versus the beginning of the third quarter. Basically means that historically low availability rates have been driven by slowed levels of store closures and then steady levels of store openings. In fact, CoreSite data that was cited in the CBRE report indicates that year-to-date store openings are basically level with 2021, but store closures are down by 55%. And that's not a headline that you'll see a lot of on major news sites. But the reality of it is store closures are down in 2022 in brick and mortar. Maybe that signals that we've seen kind of the shaking out already during the course of the pandemic of some of the less efficient brick and mortar store formats. I would argue that everything is cyclical, so might just be in a good cycle in 2022. But the fact that store openings are level with last year, store closures are down, less square footage being vacated ultimately. So that keeps absorption positive for all retail formats as long as there's still demand. And that includes retail formats like lifestyle centers and like malls. And malls, their absorption is actually positive for 2022. So kind of inching up there in terms of absorption of space. So in all what you're seeing from a retail perspective to kind of bring it all back to retail, you're seeing a lack of new space for retailers. It's pushing more retailers into centers that might not have been filled 5 years ago. Long-term leases signed by retailers have proved to be a great idea because they're keeping rates down somewhat, even if they have escalation clauses built in. But rental rates are still increasing, especially for new spaces, which, as we mentioned, there's not a whole lot of. But that's all going to disproportionately affect retailers that are opening new stores in 2022. Those long-standing retailers, those retailers that have been in spaces for a while, likely have leases and extensions in place that will keep lease rates down, at least they hope, for the near future. And aggregate retail sales numbers in both brick and mortar and e-commerce remain strong in quarter three, according to CBRE, despite the lowest consumer sentiment index in a very long time. So this all points to what may be perhaps a stronger fourth quarter than some onlookers expect, and a stronger holiday season than some expect. One onlooker who expects sales increases for the 2022 holiday season is Rick Watson. And again, we'll be joined by him after this break, the founder and CEO of RMW Commerce Consulting. He'll talk about his expectations for the holiday season and why retailers should change their planning process during mixed economic times. He goes into detail why de-siloing data might be the best thing going forward for retailers across the board, either e-commerce or otherwise. We've talked in recent episodes about expectations for the holiday season. Most of these expectations are indicating a holiday season that's more about scratching and clawing to keep market share rather than the growth-centric seasons we saw in 2020 and 2021. Here to discuss the 2022 holiday shopping season further, particularly through an e-commerce lens, is Rick Watson, the founder and CEO of RMW Commerce Consulting. Rick's retail accomplishments include launching the third-party marketplace at barnesandnoble.com and directing the cross-border product strategy of Pitney Bowes, which included the eBay Global Shipping Program. He also hosts the podcast, The Watson Weekly. Rick, thank you for joining us this week.
So glad to be on. Thank you so much for having me.
First, I was wondering if you could remind our listeners just a little bit about your personal retail background and then also what you do in the scope of RMW Commerce Consulting.
Yeah, my background is, I'm kind of one of the originals in e-commerce. I've been involved in the e-commerce industry in some fashion since 1999, starting in technology for a company called Channel Advisor, which helps a lot of retailers and brands selling on eBay and Amazon. So I've been through a number of companies in my career, from executive leadership roles to CEO. And about 3 years ago, I founded my own e-commerce consulting firm called RMW Commerce. And in that work, the problem I'm trying to solve is that private equity investors are acquiring brands and want to accelerate their growth. But many of the CEOs and management teams that are there at the time of acquisition don't understand how to really fully take advantage of e-commerce. So I help them put together strategic assessments and strategic plans so that they can make their business grow and thrive on direct-to-consumer channels, B2B e-commerce, and third-party marketplaces like Amazon.
All right, perfect. And we'll tap into some of that expertise as we go through here. But first, let's start with that 30,000-foot view, so to speak. It's important to provide some context whenever we talk about holiday sales. And I know you in particular were looking at some of the back-to-school sales and some of the data that we've seen to this point. So what is the retail sales climate looking like as we head into the holiday season?
Yeah, I think the consensus sentiment seems to be pretty consistent across the board. There are a couple of things that I see as common. Number one is consumers reprioritizing spending, which means that because grocery prices and intermittently, it seems like gas prices are rising and sometimes falling, consumers are having to stretch their budget in other ways, which means that because things that are non-discretionary, i.e. essentials that you must get for your family or pets or children, those things aren't going away, which means the amount you have left over for discretionary items is being squeezed. That's having sort of a ripple effect on, I would say, retail spending generally, particularly full priced items, particularly with lower and middle income consumers. Upper income consumers seem to be, I would say, at this point, largely unaffected because we're not seeing any kind of large scale unemployment at the moment. So what this means kind of going into the holidays is that generally sales are depressed. People aren't looking for a lot of new full priced items. And so traffic is down both in stores and websites, particularly for things like apparel and other hardline categories. And as we kind of like continue in the holidays, that is to the benefit of sites like Amazon and Walmart and other marketplaces that have wide selection of merchandise and, generally low prices and fast shipping that consumers can rely on.
All right. So we talk about the climate heading into the holiday season, where consumers might be pinched, where they might not be pinched. So given all of that, what are your overall expectations for holiday sales this year?
Yeah, I would say if you look at overall holiday sales, I would say slightly up is probably the answer. But I would say slightly up isn't always roses for each individual sector globally. So you're still going to have winners and losers within that segment. I think apparel is probably one of the hardest hit categories right now, particularly full-priced apparel. Marketplaces seem to be ones that I would say could see as much as 5 to 10% gains over last year, which means if you kind of look at the other side, a balanced forecast of 4 to 5% gain means that there's winners and losers below that. And I think the losers below that could be individual websites that are essentially discretionary items that you can generally defer the purchase of. So individual, for instance, like direct-to-consumer e-commerce sites could feel those challenges this holiday season from a volume point of view, both in traffic and units.
So you've mentioned it a couple of times. First, you said that sites like Amazon, Walmart might be in a better position simply because of not only their breadth of goods, but also their price point. You also talked about full-priced items maybe taking a little bit of a hit. So let's bring it all back to this. Could we potentially see a bounce back to a more promotional climate this year, something we really didn't see from last year when Obviously, retailers were worried about out of stocks, and it seemed like people were willing to spend money regardless of the price point.
I think that is right on. To me, a relatively straightforward, even I won't say easy, but a seemingly easy prediction this year is that if you want to get back to the same volumes as last year, you will have to be almost definitely more promotional than the previous year. So I think that hits right on line with what you're saying.
All right. So we've talked a little bit about these macro factors coming in. You know, obviously, non-discretionary products, you see price points going up. Gas prices, as you mentioned, are fluctuating. We know that we could see potentially decreasing sales in certain categories, but I'm wondering what other ways these macro factors might affect shopping patterns, shopping habits, and shopping decisions, especially as it pertains to e-commerce.
I think shopping decisions in situations like this, people are going back to the names that they trust. And so when you think about how I'm making shopping decisions, I think there are a couple of things going on. Number one is consumers are thinking to me in this order, like, number one, can I defer this purchase? Which means maybe I won't make this purchase at all. Second is, if I need to make this purchase, can I trade down almost like a category of retailer and make a similar quality purchase? For instance, if I'm used to buying at, I would say, full price retail like a Macy's, can I buy this in an off-price environment like a Sam's Club or a Costco or a Marshall's or Home Goods or like whatever it is? So I'm trying to trade down category to make my dollar stretch further. Then three is, if it is an item that is maybe on many different places online, I'm likely, and just kind of general merchandise, I'm probably going to go back to someplace I trust, like an Amazon or a Walmart, that I know and can trust the prices and then their availability. And particularly during the holidays, one thing that happens is, like, if you're buying a random item in August, you may be willing to wait a week or at least take the risk of waiting a week for it to come here. The closer it gets to the holiday season, the more shipping performance and cost weighs in on your transaction. I would say hardly any season, but I think in seasons like this, free shipping, I would say, has a bigger impact than normal.
I do want to ask just a quick follow-up in regards to shipping, because we know, obviously, free shipping, deals on shipping, that does drive some consumer decisions as far as the purchase is concerned. But for those of us that aren't involved in e-commerce on a day-in, day-out basis, what's the state of shipping and fulfillment here as we head into the last quarter of 2022?
The interesting thing is I would say, supply chain from the point of view of, if you have an item in stock, can you get it to your consumer on time? We're pretty much over most of the COVID issues with that situation, except for the isolated cases where maybe a company can't hire enough labor for a particular facility or region at the moment. We're not really at the point where we expect the entire shipping system to be overloaded like 2 years ago because all retail stores were offline and as a result, all purchases were going e-commerce. So we're kind of well past that point from a shipping point of view. If you're kind of like outside of e-commerce, I would say the thing to remember about shipping is that there's sort of two elements. One is how much it costs, and two, how quickly can you get it to someone? And almost every survey ever done that I've seen on shipping indicates something like the cost of shipping is about 3 to 4 times more important than the speed. Not that speed is unimportant, but most consumers will take free shipping over a $5 or $10 shipping that's a little bit faster. So I think that's another reason why sites like Amazon and Walmart will benefit in an environment like this.
All right. So all that being said, obviously, we're pretty late in the game for retailers to make vast sweeping changes to maybe adjust for the last 2 months of the year. Obviously, we know product has been ordered and strategy has been planned, etc. But what are some maybe smaller adjustments retailers could or should be employing to make themselves more attractive to the consumer in this climate, particularly in some of those sectors like the DTC sectors that you said might be taking a little bit more of a hit compared to the last couple of years?
Yeah, I think a couple of things. Number one is ensuring that their shipping processes are tuned. They're getting items out of their warehouses quickly. Their customer service is very reliable. So that if someone asks the status of their order, people are getting responses to those things. I always start with the operational side of the equation because that's really the foundation of any e-commerce business. It's really all about operations. Kind of moving forward in the stack, I think there are a couple of things to look at. Number one is across your catalog, really understanding what is it that you believe are going to be your key winners this year and ensuring that your merchandising strategy, meaning the items that you're promoting after someone lands on your website, really line up with that strategy. They're always in stock and that they're refreshed and give a buyer a reason to come back on the site and ensure that there's something interesting there. And then second is like kind of beyond that on the front end and top of the funnel is ensuring that your marketing is extremely clear and has a message that has some punch that really stands out in a very promotional environment. And so I think most brands that are probably not luxury brands will need to be a bit more promotional this holiday season and just sort of get that in their head. I'm not going to make as many full price sales as I did last year.
So you mentioned the promotional aspect, but I did want to follow up on the marketing aspect itself. What type of climate are we seeing as far as marketing for these e-commerce companies across the board? And where are we at in terms of marketing compared to maybe the last couple of years in the holiday season?
Yeah, I think marketing, if you look at kind of direct consumer marketing on traditional sites like Facebook and Google, it's still relatively strong. I would say the ROI on Facebook has declined sort of historically over the last couple of years, just because of they're not able to target as well as they used to. But I think brands that have great products that meet a consumer need are still breaking through in this environment. I was looking at a survey earlier this week where if you look at the top media agencies, which essentially run advertising spend for all the major brands in the world, like some of the biggest media agencies, is that new spend so far, like up to the first 8 months of the year, was down something like 38% from like an advertising spend point of view. So advertising spend is down. And I think companies are, just like consumers are sort of curbing their own discretionary spending, I think companies are getting in the same mode. Jeff Bezos said on Twitter yesterday that companies should start battening down the hatches, whatever that means. Kind of reminds me of COVID sheltering in place. The good and bad thing about digital marketing spend on the whole, as opposed to employees, is that digital marketing is something you can dial up or down very quickly. So it's a variable cost that if you want to reduce that number to save some margin, or you know, if you don't have enough stock and it's okay to sort of extend the season a little bit, you can reduce your advertising throughput.
And that's a very good point. And marketing, one of those things that can be adjusted almost on an instantaneous basis there. I want to change gears here because even though this isn't particularly dealing with the holiday season at hand, recently you had a blog post on your website that I found quite interesting, basically about how companies' planning processes should change during these mixed economic times like what we're in right now. And I was wondering if you could expand on that article a little bit and what that change in the planning process might look like for retailers.
What I see, so I mean, a lot of times I work with brands and you work with management teams, and management teams tend to be in silos. Like there is some collaboration, but a lot of times that collaboration only happens when their boss is in the room. And so when their boss leaves the room, then the marketing team wants to talk to their own marketing team members, and the sales team wants to talk to the sales team members, and the supply chain team is sort of off on their own dealing with whatever kind of rolls downhill. And so the reality is that each of them have their own set of data that they're looking for. Marketing is looking at consumer sentiment, trends. The product team might be looking at one set of data. Supply chain is looking at forecasting, and sales is just trying to hit their quota for the year. But in a mixed economic time, each of these groups actually has a very unique perspective on what the customer is doing and how should we react to it as a business. So to the extent that these groups are not talking to each other, what you generally have is these groups are not working from the same set of facts. And the resulting impact of that is that the company will react more slowly in the market than someone that has an integrated planning process. Imagine if you have the leader of the marketing, sales, supply chain, merchandising team meeting every day, every hour. I'm not saying they need to meet this often, but they would all share the same set of facts and information all the time. Now, I don't think anyone needs to go to that sort of extreme, but I think it's no exaggeration to say sometimes these departments barely meet monthly, depending on which company you talk to, especially in times where things are pretty predictable. You're looking at the whole company may be measured on a 20% year-over-year growth curve, But I think when I talk about mixed economic times, the number one thing I mean when I say that is the category mix that you're expecting your sales from, let's say you're in four major categories, what that mix has been historically may not be what it is in the next few months as consumers change their shopping behavior. So having your business leaders, particularly your important business leaders in the company, kind of aligned on the same set of consumer realities and what changes are being made to the business to deal with those realities, I think couldn't be more important right now.
And that's some great insight into kind of, so to speak, how the sausage is made, or maybe how the sausage should be made in certain circumstances. I wanted to wrap up on this because I think I mentioned your podcast in the beginning, The Watson Weekly. I think it's a fantastic podcast. If you want to learn anything about e-commerce and what's going on in a particular week, you can listen to it. But I'm kind of curious what the idea was in terms of starting that podcast up and what listeners could expect if they tune into that podcast.
Yeah, I would say the original idea behind the podcast is really giving a short capsule to listeners every week on this is the news of the week you need to pay attention to, and not just news. There are a lot of places to get news, but you know, essentially my analysis and reasons behind the news, sort of what's happening, why is this company doing this, what do I feel about it, so that then they can take this information back and make decisions about their brand, their software company, like wherever they are in e-commerce. There are lots of people that are coming in new and fresh to the e-commerce industry all the time. And so having a place where you're not just seeing that a company is doing X or Y, that doesn't really tell them anything, because this could be something that experienced executives don't think is going to work, but they think it's a big new idea, you know, because they're new to the space. So having someone as a guide to help point them in the direction of what's going to happen, I think is useful. What listeners will find as they come to the podcast is really two things. Number one, sort of a short list of topics every week, really no other filter than the most interesting to me on some of the biggest companies in the day and the news that's happening that week. I also have a segment at the end of the podcast called the Investor Minute. And the Investor Minute is really news about new venture capital and private equity investments that are happening. And I like to track investor news because it gives us some idea of what's next in the industry. So if a venture capitalist who has a 7 to 10 year investment time horizon is investing in, and I'm just going to pick an example, like supply chain intelligence, then that means that's a new and growing trend. That's not something that was kind of an old idea that is 20 years old that people don't need to pay attention to. It's something new in the industry that investors are trying to shake up because they see some opportunity and it makes sense for us to pay attention to.
Well, I can't recommend the podcast enough personally, but Rick, I really appreciate you taking the time, shining some light on what you're seeing for this upcoming holiday season, and we look forward to talking to you again in the future.
All right. Thanks a lot, Trent. I appreciate you having me on.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
We thank Rick for rejoining us on the podcast, and it's always great to hear from him. And again, I mentioned it during the course of the interview, but I really do enjoy his weekly podcast. You know, we don't talk a ton about e-commerce, especially e-commerce pure play news on our podcast, but he does a great job in 10 to 15 minutes of covering everything you need to know on a weekly basis. So big shout out to him and his production crew for knocking out that podcast every single week. Now we're going to look ahead to another delivery service being taken to court by another municipality, basically. The attorney generals in the District of Columbia and Minnesota are suing Shipt. Shipt, of course, owned by Target. So one of the reasons why you think Minnesota is involved there, certainly. But basically, the guise of the lawsuit is this, that Shipt's personal shoppers are independent contractors currently. These attorneys general feel as though they're full employees, and therefore they should have various sick time, various forms of overtime pay, and also minimum wage protections, as well as any other benefits that go along with being full employees of the company of Shipt. Now, when you look at a lawsuit like this, you immediately look back to other lawsuits that have happened. Instacart, versus San Diego was certainly one issue earlier. And something also that the federal government has really been working towards. In fact, just earlier this month, they kind of published a little bit of a guide for various employers surrounding independent contracting versus what constitutes a regular employee. I'll be upfront, I have very limited knowledge of the delineation between independent contracting and full-on employment with a business, whether it be a retailer or someone else. But what I do know, and certainly what I have learned over the years, is that, you know, a lot of times it is very easy to kind of step over that line from independent contractor to employee. Companies obviously have been able to skirt it for quite a while. You look at Uber, for example, coming under fire. Obviously, Instacart, we've already mentioned, come under fire. And now Shipt is the latest company to come under fire for this. Now, at the same time, Shipt is saying, for their part, that, hey, it's the flexible work environment that actually makes them maybe not full employees on our behalf, because they can work where and how much they want to. Pretty much the definition there of independent contractors. But there are a lot of other things that go into building that definition of what an independent contractor is, like how much in terms of the company material you use, how much of the company technology you use, and so forth. And I know this has been an issue actually with media companies and radio stations and TV stations in the past. And that's oftentimes where those lawsuits and those conflicts have come up, is in terms of equipment usage, in terms of what you get from the business in order to be able to complete your independent contractor work. And so I think that's probably where the state of Minnesota and the District of Columbia are making their argument. Minnesota's Attorney General is Keith Ellison, and he basically says, and I quote this, "I'm suing Shipt because instead of playing by the rules most Minnesota employers play by, Shipt is taking advantage of Minnesotans to enrich itself while leaving workers to fend for themselves. Unlike other employees, these workers have no clarity on how much they'll be paid day to day, and they don't receive the minimum wage and overtime they're entitled to." So he talks about why he's battling Shipt in this circumstance, but he doesn't speak to exactly what he is citing as far as why he feels as though Shipt is misclassifying their employees. Ultimately, as we're fond of saying on the podcast, the only winners from this will probably be lawyers for both parties. But I do think the reason to look ahead at this story is the more and more you see states and municipalities take these companies to court, the more and more you're going to see restrictions surrounding maybe who these companies hire, who these companies choose to hire, where these companies do business, and also some of the benefits that they can give the employees while they're still on their staff. And I think this is interesting because you have this independent contractor model from Shipt, and Shipt says, hey, well, this is one of the reasons why people like working for us, is they can choose where they work and how much they work and so forth, which jobs they take, which jobs they don't. But then you look at a retailer like Schnucks, who we talked about just a few weeks ago on the Looking Ahead segment of the podcast, how they're rolling out their own platform. And they were very clear in saying, hey, people can choose which shifts they take, how much they work, all of this for the flexible work employees. And oh, by the way, they are classified as employees of Schnucks and have access to all the benefits that other employees of Schnucks have. So I think you're going to see more and more of that model moving forward. The question really going ahead is this going to be a sustainable model for companies like Shipt, for companies like Instacart going ahead to kind of move away from that independent contractor classification? I would imagine it is. I would imagine that it's not going to be that damaging to margins, but it does make things a little bit more complex, not only in terms of the payroll side, but also in terms of the operational side. So lots of questions to be answered in some of this gig economy work. And I'm really excited to see how things shake out over the next year, because this is something that no doubt retailers themselves, you talk about Walmart, who's another company at looking into maybe promoting gig economy type work. Other companies that are out there are going to be keeping a close eye on this. And so I think it's important for us to do the same here on the podcast and for those in the retail community to pay close attention to the argument of independent contractor versus employee. Well, that'll do it for us on this week's podcast. Coming up next week, we're scheduled to be joined by Rick Kelly, who is the CPO at FuelCycle. Really excited about this interview because we're going to talk about private label brands and private label brands appearing in retail stores, private label developments, and also how consumers are increasingly, especially given the scope of inflation, looking to these private label brands for deals inside stores. So it's something that we talk about from time to time on the podcast, really haven't discussed in an interview segment in about a year. So excited to dive into that and their recent white paper surrounding a number of data points regarding private label products. So excited for that interview. Thank you for joining us this week, and we'll look forward to being back with you about 7 days from now.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.